The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning will be Tiberiu Weiss, author of a new book that translates the legendary Kaifeng stone inscriptions of the Chinese Jewish community. We'll also have visits from our Jewish ethics mavina, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, and our international Jewish expert, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's fastest-growing synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. We're sponsored as well by Environmental Strategies, by Jill Rich, and by Janos Restaurant and the J Bar. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's the first day after Hanukkah today, the aftermath of the wonderful holiday of latkes and lights. After 8 days of eating seriously fried foods and chocolate gelt, it's time for a little bit lighter fare. By tradition, on December 24th, we Jews shift over to eating, believe it or not, Chinese food. You see, the only places open December 24th at night are restaurants run by non-Christians, like Buddhists. And the only people eating out on December 24th are Jews. So traditional Jewish foods tonight include egg roll, fried rice, wonton, and so on. Our own temple pioneered the showing of a Chinese-oriented movie. Tonight's offering at Tucson's Temple Emmanuel is the outstanding documentary Shanghai Ghetto at 7 tonight, paired with kosher vegetarian Chinese food as a way of meeting the needs of all on this important event. And let me tell you, we Jews know our Chinese. As the Jewish lead in the movie My Favorite Year tells his non-Jewish date,
Catherine, Jews know two things, suffering and where to find great Chinese food.
In honor of the season, this is the time to find great Chinese food, or at least the passable stuff you can find here in the Southwest. But this day and tomorrow bring great memories for me every year, with or without Chinese food. You see, my youngest child, my daughter Tsipora, was born December 25, 2000, in St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tucson, Arizona. As it happened, or rather as God willed it, she was born at 5 a.m. or so, and about 2 hours later there was a knock at the door. Seems that a reporter was there from the news station. She wanted to film the first baby born on Christmas Day in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital here. And Tsipora Kohan was the one. So I went out in the hall and discovered that the reporter naturally was Jewish. After all, who else works Christmas morning? Her name was Karen, and she's a member of my own Temple Emmanuel, and she asked if it would be okay to film, Rabbi. I said, you can film, Karen, but you have to say that the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Hospital is actually the rabbi's daughter from Temple Emmanuel, and she's a Hanukkah baby. By the way, Tzipora is quite sure nowadays that all the stores are closed in honor of her birthday. And who am I to argue? Anyway, tonight and tomorrow are special in lots of ways. And this story gives me a great excuse to play a favorite song from Israeli artist Yehudit Ravitz. In Tzipora's birthday's honor tomorrow, Hayalda Achi Yafa Bagan, the prettiest girl in the school.
בגן יש לה עיניים הכי יפות בגן וצמא הכי יפה בגן ופה הכי יפה בגן וכמה שמביטים ביותר רואים שאין מה לדבר והיא הילדה הכי יפה יפה בגן כשהיא מחייכת גם אני מחייכת וכשהיא עצובה אני לא מבינה איך אפשר להיות עצובה כשאת הילדה הכי יפה בגן הילדה הכי יפה בגן יש לה עיניים הכי הפירות בגן וצמח הכי יפה בגן ופה הכי יפה בגן וכמה שמביטים ביותר רואים שאין מה לדבר והיא הילדה הכי יפה יפה בגן כשהיא מחייכת גם אני מחייכת וכשהיא עצובה אני לא מבינה איך אפשר להיות עצובה שאת הילדה הכי יפה בגן לא 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 שמביטים ביותר רואים שאין מה לדבר והיא הילדה הכי יפה יפה בגן
That was Yehudit Ravitz, prettiest girl in the actually preschool is a gun. My daughter's now in kindergarten, but in Israel, they often start school formally in first grade, so kindergarten's kind of like preschool. It still seems appropriate. I know that Hanukkah 5767 is now officially in our rearview mirror, although you can expect to see Happy Hanukkah on your TV screen at every reasonably ecumenical football bowl game right up through New Year's. But even though Hanukkah has come and gone, it's worthwhile playing a final post-Hanukkah musical cut. Here's a ridiculous offering from Eric Schwartz, the rather comical Smooth E, performing in rap the Hanukkah Bird.
This is Copter 1 reporting a large flying object. Looks like a bird carrying presents. It appears to be wearing a yarmulke.
It's time to light the menorah, see, while the majority are eating fruitcake with Santa, I'm dancing the horror week, feeling so horribly, cause Santa ignoring me, touring globally, but ain't got nothing for poor old me, but that's enough to make a kid blow out the candles, jealousy, no tree, and nothing on my mantle, I had eight presents, but not one from the claw, so heap hoppers, listen up, here's one who's down for the cause, the Hanukkah bird, the Hanukkah bird, you heard my words, even though they sound absurd, you can recognize him from his blue and white turd, flies around the world and best believe he's insured. He's scared. All of your worries are cured. He drops off the present on the first, second, and third nights to the eighth flights from the North Pole.
Wrong.
He's a Jewish bird. His home's in Boca Raton.
Who's that knocking on the door with his big 8 days a week? He's so unique. He's the Hanukkah bird, the Hanukkah bird. He's the Hanukkah bird, the Hanukkah bird.
You heard?
Who's that knocking on the door with his big 8 days a week? He's such a freak. He's the Hanukkah bird, the Hanukkah bird.
Manischewitz from a man Hanukkah Harry. He died, but he trained this bird in his aviary. If you want him to come, do like we do. When he knocks with his beak, count to 10 in Hebrew.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, whatever, I failed Hebrew 1. Just give him a chance to fly away, cause if you see him, the legend's done. Don't leave cookies, he'll get sick if he eat it. Don't write a list, he can't freaking read it. Kids wanna meet him, but they can't see him. Adults wanna be him, cats wanna eat him. He's a bird working like a dog for 8 nights. Grips presents in his talons when he takes flight. It's the gift blocking, kid rocking, hip hopping, door knocking, more shopping, floor dropping.
More socks.
And you're talking.
Who's that knocking on the door with his big 8 days a week? It's so unique. He's the Hanukkah bird, the Hanukkah bird.
SuburbanHomeboy.com is on for Hanukkah and beyond. Peace. Shalom.
That was Smoothie Eric Schwartz, sounding like a Jewish version of the early Will Smith in his DJ Jazzy Jeff phase. Just don't flip anyone the Hanukkah bird in this season of competing holidays. We got a great show for you this morning, appropriate to this night when we will feast on Chinese food. When we come back, we'll meet our guest, Tiberio Weiss, author of a new book of translations of the famous Chinese inscriptions of the Kaifeng Stones, right here on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning Tiberio Weiss, who has performed a signal service by translating the Kaifeng stone inscriptions into a lucid and clear English. This is a most interesting Jewish community, the community of the Jews of China. Mr. Weiss is, as he puts it in his own biography, a layperson with over 30 years of business and academic experience in Chinese study and in China, fluent in Chinese and Hebrew. He has taught Hebrew history and Chinese religion at local colleges, published articles, and translated a book into Chinese. Currently, he is teaching advanced Chinese, lives with his wife and family in Minnesota, where it is much colder than it is in Arizona. Good morning, Mr. Weiss.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the Chinese Jewish community that led to these Kaifeng stone inscriptions.
By the time, at the end of the 15th century, you know, when the Chinese wrote these inscriptions, they already were in China for at least 1,500 years. And the way I figured that out is tracing back the inscriptions, the text of the inscription, which included prayers and rituals, that dated back to the pre-rabbinic period, possibly even to the First Temple period. And that's why they kept this tradition, through all their tradition, all the way, you know, from since when they came there in the first century CE or until you know, they wrote these inscriptions. They felt that the community was dwindling at the time, and that's why they wrote in 1489, they wrote the first inscription.
So they were sort of trying to preserve in stone this community that was of great ancients, going back to perhaps the destruction of the Second Temple.
That's correct. What they tried to do is tell the next generation, because they were afraid that they will die out, they wanted to let the next generation of Chinese Jews to know what the prayers are. They said, if you are going to pray the Aleinu, and if you are going to pray the Amidah, and the Birkat HaKohanim, then you are going to be a Jew.
It's remarkable, and these inscriptions reflect some very interesting things. You note that there's a strong Confucian influence in the Chinese Jewish practice, or at least in the way it sort of developed. Can you explain that a little bit?
Certainly. It's much more than strong. It's very, very many similarities. But I think, you know, that some of us, you know, who are not very knowledgeable about China, they always think that Confucius was the first person who we have to compare the Jews. I think that we have to compare to much earlier literature, which I think, you know, it's more in line with the Torah. Confucius basically, like Moses, he said that I was the first teacher, so did Moses. Moses said I was the first teacher to the Jews, and Confucius said the same thing. But if you look at the history of the Chinese way before Confucius, several centuries before that, then we find out that the Chinese record, they are very close to the spirit, very close in spirit to the Torah, and what the Chinese Jews did then, basically, you know, at the time they were all accepted that it was Confucianism. They just used some of the quotes from Confucius and they inserted it in the inscription.
Remarkable. And inserted into inscriptions that include prayers and quotations from the Tanakh.
Correct. And that was not found before.
Remarkable. We will talk much more with Tiberio Weiss about the very interesting Kaifeng stone inscriptions and the little known but quite fascinating Jewish community of ancient China when we come back here on Two Jewish.
Temple Emmanuel, the largest and fastest growing Reform congregation in Southern Arizona, invites you to become a part of all the wonderful ways we explore Judaism. Are you new in town? Call us for a tour and an information packet. Like to know more about Judaism? From an outstanding preschool program and excellent Reform religious school to the finest adult education academy in the country, Temple Emmanuel offers contemporary Jewish learning with depth, authenticity, and creativity. Try our outreach classes and our hugely popular Taste of Judaism series. And if you're looking for the best Jewish music in town, this is the place. From our string quartet to our Avanim rock band, we include every variety of outstanding Jewish music available. Most importantly, we make Judaism fun and meaningful. Come join us at Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road. Call 327-4501 today. Get connected.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetcher Kfell, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows by contacting us through the website, Two Jewish Radio, or just download them there or at the Apple iTunes store as podcasts. In keeping with the spirit of the season, I thought I would play a bit of a carol, believe it or not, as written by that great Jewish satirist Tom Lehrer. You know, I'm a little tired of carols by now. This one is called, fittingly, a Christmas carol.
It's always seemed to me, after all, that Christmas, with its spirit of giving, offers us all a wonderful opportunity each year to reflect on what we all most sincerely and deeply believe in. I refer, of course, to money. Yet none of the Christmas carols that you hear on the radio or in the street even attempts to capture the true spirit of Christmas as we celebrate it in the United States. That is to say, the commercial spirit. So I should like to offer the following Christmas carol for next year as being perhaps a bit more appropriate. Christmas time is here, by golly, disapproval would be folly. Deck the halls with hunks of holly, fill a cup and don't say when. Kill the turkeys, ducks, and chickens, mix the punch, drag out the dickens. Even though the prospect sickens, brother, here we go again. On Christmas Day, you can't get sore. Your fellow man you must adore. There's time to rob him all the more. The other 306 a day of war. Relations, sparing no expense'll, send some useless old utensil or a matching pen and pencil. Just the thing I need. How nice. It doesn't matter how sincere it is, nor how heartfelt the spirit. Sentiment will not endear it. What's important is the price. Hark, the Herald Tribune sings, advertising wondrous things. God rest ye merry merchants, may ye make the Yuletide pay. Angels we have heard on high tell us to go out and buy. So let the raucous sleigh bells jingle, hail our dear old friend Kris Kringle, driving his reindeer across the sky. Don't stand underneath when they fly by.
The great humorist Tom Lehrer, who also wrote the novelty tune Chanukah in Santa Monica, singing about the true spirit of the holiday so many non-Jewish Americans are celebrating tonight and tomorrow. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, our Mavinta, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Amy, I know a lot of families where there's a, it's appropriate to this time of year, where there's a Jewish spouse and a Christian spouse, and they, you say, how are you raising your kids? They say, well, we're going to let the kids decide. How do you feel about that from an ethical point of view, from the creation of moral values?
It's a really great question, and especially at this time of year when kids are faced with the societal kind of tension and pressure on celebrating a holiday that seems almost more American than it does Christian, which is Christmas. I feel very...
I knew that that was the holiday you were going to refer
to.
Yeah,
I wasn't thinking of Kwanzaa.
It wasn't the solstice.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. Okay. So the real issue, I think, is to not force a child to make a decision as to what they are going to choose, whether they're going to choose to be Jewish or Christian. For in a child's mind, that's not really what they're choosing. What they're choosing, I think, is, are they going to side more with mommy, who may be Jewish, or daddy, who may be Christian? And that's a pretty impossible place to put a kid in, because, in fact, they end up feeling guilty any way they go. And then it's related, I think, ultimately to the choice that they make about their religion, that they have actually chosen not to be something.
So it's really not so much a cultural question or, in some sense, a religious question for a family to decide. It's becomes a power struggle at that point.
I think, yeah, and I also think the sensitivity to understanding that it's there's an internal struggle that a small child goes through that is both developmental and emotional, but it's also going to affect long-term relationship that they will have to their God, to their tradition. And so I think, you know, in a healthy family, you talk about the tension and you talk about the struggle and you talk about how, you know, two people who come together who love each other and make a child had different and have different religious traditions, but that for the family's sake, they are going to choose to really develop one. And perhaps, you know, if the child shows an interest in the other, then certainly to look at the other and to explore the other, but not perhaps in following those traditions. So, for example, I think it, you know, it sounds like a lovely concept to have both a tree and a menorah, but if the child then wants just one or the other, again, it's really choosing the parent as opposed to the religion at that early age.
Doesn't the parent have to make that decision rather than the kid?
I think that two people, you know, who are married, who are taking on the responsibility of raising a child, have to look at that and come to the decision themselves. What is in the best interest of the family to do? And I would agree that it has to really come from the parent.
In Mishlei, in Proverbs, it says, raise a child well, and he won't stray from that tradition. In other words, raise them in a moral tradition, and they'll follow that through as adults. And so our collective recommendation is choose one and make sure that the kid knows that that's the choice.
Exactly.
Thanks, Amy. We will talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And now a word of Torah. This week we reach the climax of the great story of Joseph, which fills most of the last five weekly portions in the book of Genesis. As we begin this week's great portion of Vayigash, Joseph has risen to the position of number two man in all of Egypt. He has become, in Yiddish, as my dad likes to say, a poritz, an important man, a macher, a guy who has assimilated and taken on a role that few Jews have really held. As my dad again, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan's song tells it.
Yosef Avinu is in Mitzrayim a poritz geworden. Translation. Little Joe, he made it big in Egypt. Seine eigene Brüder, ob ihn nicht gekannt, ob ihn nicht gekannt. Translation. His own brothers didn't know him anymore, they didn't dig him anymore. Und vor was haben sie ihn nicht gekannt? Why didn't they know him? Ist gestanden in der Mitte. Ois wie ein Poritz und er rett wie ein Poritz. Unser Josele ist nur Sabbat in Translation. He looked like a Poritz and he talked like a Poritz in a language that his brothers didn't know. He looked like a Poritz and he talked like a Poritz. That couldn't be our little Joe.
Joseph's brothers, who had earlier sold him into slavery and don't know that he has come way up in the world since then, come down to Egypt because food is short in Canaan. But as the song continues,
hat sie gekannt und sie haben ihn nicht gekannt. He knew them and they didn't know him. But now listen, how could they possibly know it? I mean, here he was with the beard shaved off in this beautiful penthouse completely overlooking the Nile. Elegantly furnished in early on Gipachkin. and between him and them
are standing the aristocrats and the big shots and the interpreters. And besides, like I told you before, Are you ready? He looked like a Boritz, and he talked like a Boritz, in a language that his brothers didn't know. He looked like a Boritz, and he talked like a Boritz, that couldn't be our little Joe. Finally, Joe himself couldn't stand it anymore. He said, send them all out. All the aristocrats, the big shots, the inter, send them all out. And he faced his brothers directly, and he spoke to them for the first time in Hebrew. And he said to them, Ani Yosef. Translation, Ich bin Yosef. Adavichai, said, is my father still alive? They looked at him, and they looked at each other, and they said, it can't be, but it is. Yes, this is our brother. They said, yes, you have a father, you have a family, you have an identity. Yes, they said, we know you now because you're speaking our language, of course.
In other words, Joseph comes to recognize he has to affirm his own Jewish identity. He has brothers, a father, an existence beyond his job and his own assimilated identity. He is a Jew, and that matters deeply and profoundly. That's the essential meaning of this Torah portion of Vayigash. It is why we are here and why our lives truly matter. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And happy just after Hanukkah. We began last week talking about the natural nations of the Middle East and really the peoples that make up those areas, the Turks, of course, with Turkey and a few other nations, the Persians with Iran and some neighboring nations, and then the Arabs. And what the only real natural Arab country, we talked about the Arabs as a nation that really is no longer a nation and hasn't been for a long time. The natural nation you talked about is Egypt, the one that has a prehistory of nationhood and continues to have sort of geographic reasons to remain a nation. Explore that a little bit, if you would.
Well, it's an interesting and obviously very touchy and sensitive subject, but what makes those three nation states unique in the region, namely Egypt, Turkey, and Iran, is that although all three of them currently have fairly arbitrary borders, they all have a pre-Islamic identity and a pre-Islamic culture. In the case of the Turks, it was imported from very far to the east. The Turks originally came from the area around Lake Baikal in eastern Siberia and are relatively late arrivals in Asia Minor. I mean, they didn't get there until the 11th or 12th century.
They didn't finish conquering until 1453
right.
or something.
The Battle of Manzikert, which occurred in 1071, signaled the arrival of the Seljuk Turks in Asia Minor in a big way, and they finally took over all of what is today Turkey by 1453 with the conquest of Constantinople, which until then had been the capital of the Byzantine Empire. But whether their recent arrivals are or an ancient presence, the Turks, the Persians, and the Egyptians all have glorious pre-Islamic pasts to recall, to refer back to. They have cultures that are distinct, and they have, with the exception of Egypt, languages which are distinct. Now, Egypt is an Arabic-speaking country. It is not 100% Arab. It's not 100% Muslim. But it long considered itself the natural leader of the Arab world because of its intellectual preeminence. It had the first university in the Arab world. But it was never the seat of the caliph. It was never the seat of the emperor of all the Arabs or the Amir al-Mu'minin or any of the other titles by which the leader of the Arab world was called through the centuries of Arab domination. you'll recall that the earliest capitals of the Muslims were in the Arabian Peninsula. Then there was Damascus under the Umayyads for about 100 years. And then for 400 years, Baghdad under the Abbasids was the capital of the Arab world until it was sacked by the Mongols. I think we may be out of time, so let's continue this interesting discussion next week.
We'll talk next week, Tom. Thanks. When we return, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant in the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
It's fall, my favorite season of all, and the foods are different and delicious.
I always look forward to the fall like I look forward to every season because that's when we change the menu. In fact, this morning I'm going out. We're picking up squash and melons off of the farm. We bring in foraged mushrooms out of the Northwest. Great new seafood. It's a really fun time to come to the restaurant for all the fall foods.
And the flavors are really rich in the fall, aren't they?
Well, in the fall when things kind of start getting a little cooler here. The dishes are richer, they're warmer, they're inviting. Great flavors and just really fun things to be eating.
So, what's your favorite fall food?
Wild foraged mushrooms.
I can't wait. I'm salivating now. What's the number for Janos and the J-Bar?
615-6100. Check out the menus at www.janos.com.
Janos, we will see you soon at J-Bar and at Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Humor your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris was the caretaker at the synagogue, and he asked for a raise. But he was turned down, budget cuts and all. So in frustration, he resigned and went to the Catholic Church to seek gainful employment. There, the priest asked him, "We'd like to hire you, Morris, but you have to show some knowledge of our faith. Where was Jesus born?" And Morris answered, "Where was Jesus born? In Pittsburgh." He was told he couldn't have the job. So then he tried the Baptist church, and the minister said Morris could have the job if he could answer just one question. "And where was Jesus born?" "In Philadelphia," Morris answered, and was thrown out. He was walking away sadly when he ran into the rabbi, who told him, Morris, the board voted unanimously to approve your raise. Please come back, Morris." And Morris answered, "Rabbi, I'll come back, but only if you answer a question for me. Where was Jesus born?" "In Bethlehem," said the rabbi. And Morris cried out, "I knew it was in Pennsylvania." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, and a kind of a timely one. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you, you should live and be well. You can get CDs, many and all past shows, for a nominal fee. Call Temple Emmanuel at 520-327-4501. Visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com or come to the Apple iTunes store and download a podcast. When we come back, we'll get the news of Jews around the world.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your Bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your Bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert made a surprise visit to Amman, Jordan, to see King Abdullah this past week. Both men seem genuinely interested in reviving the collapsed peace process and perhaps working to avert a full-blown civil war in the Palestinian Authority, if it's possible. King Abdullah invited Olmert very publicly to come to Jordan, which has a majority of Palestinians among its citizens, and the embattled Israeli prime minister took him up on the invitation immediately. It's not clear that anything much will come of these talks, but like chicken soup, when you have the flu, it couldn't hurt. In an explosive telephone argument that led to her firing, hot publisher Judith Regan allegedly complained of a Jewish cabal against her in the book industry and stated that Jews should know about ganging up, finding common enemies, and telling the big lie. Oy. A spokesman for Regan's former employer, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, said that the remarks were made during a conversation between Regan and HarperCollins' attorney Mark Jackson, who took notes, not very smart of her. At the time, the two were discussing the future of a controversial new novel about baseball star Mickey Mantle. Regan's legal representative, Hollywood attorney Burt Fields, who is Jewish, had called earlier reports of inappropriate remarks completely untrue and added that the publisher didn't have an anti-Semitic bone in her body, but maybe in her tongue. Since 1994, Regan has headed up the Regan Books imprint at News Corp's HarperCollins. She was fired at the end of last week because of the scandal. The allegations first emerged earlier in the week when the New York Times, citing two unnamed News Corp officials, of course, referred to these unspecified anti-Semitic comments. Regan, one of the book world's most successful and temperamental publishers, reportedly had a long history of tension with HarperCollins CEO Jane Friedman, who is Jewish, even as Murdoch supported her. But last month, Murdoch canceled a book, If I Did It, her planned O.J. Simpson bio and Fox television interview. Simpson's book, said to have described how he theoretically would have committed the murders of ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman, who again was Jewish, had been scheduled for release November 30th following the airing of a two-part Simpson interview on TV. Its announcement was greeted with universal disgust, and the project was called off despite Regan's vehement defense of what she called Simpson's confession. Regan's tirade last week marks the latest such outburst by a public figure. In July, good old Mel Gibson uttered anti-Semitic slurs after being arrested on suspicion of drunk driving. The Academy Award-winning filmmaker later apologized for his vitriolic and harmful words. News Corp and Fields offered widely different versions of the phone call between Regan in L.A. and Jackson in New York. The gist of it was Regan was frustrated by what she believed was her publisher's lack of support for her new Mickey Mantle book and lashed out, complaining that Jackson, Jane Friedman, and executive editor David Hershey and longtime literary agent Esther Newberg were a Jewish cabal. HarperCollins has been unclear about what will happen to Regan Books, her label. It produced a long series of racy bestsellers from Jenna Jameson's How to Make Love Like a Porn Star to Jose Canseco's steroid tell-all, Juiced. Very classy stuff. Perhaps Regan will follow Mel into rehab. Clearly we need some remedial treatment centers for popular culture's leading anti-Semites. In other news, Kofi Annan retired last week as head of the UN. His final speech managed to criticize both Israel and the Palestinians, whom he declared to be equally responsible for the failure to advance the cause of peace in the Middle East. Yep, let's be balanced. For the UN, it was as balanced as it gets. We'll see what his successor, Ban Ki-moon of South Korea, brings to the table. Israel's Supreme Court ruled last week that some Palestinians injured by the Israeli military may sue the state for compensation, a decision hailed as groundbreaking by an Arab civil rights group, but condemned by right-wing Israeli lawmakers as damaging the country's security. A panel of nine judges unanimously voted to invalidate an Israeli law imposing a blanket ban on compensation claims regarding conflict areas, but they left intact another statute exempting the state for claims for damage or injury incurred specifically during military operations against an activist or member of a terrorist organization. Again, this demonstrates Israel's free and democratic system, its willingness to place justice above bias. Would that its neighbors' systems worked the same way. And circumcision appears to reduce men's risks of contracting AIDS from heterosexual sex by half, U.S. government health officials say. The directors of the two largest funds for fighting the disease said they would consider paying for circumcisions in high-risk countries. I see a future for Moyles. The announcement was made by officials of the National Institutes of Health as they halted two clinical trials in Kenya and Uganda on the ground that not offering circumcision to all the men taking part would be unethical because there's so much benefit. The success of the trials confirmed a study done last year in South Africa. AIDS experts hailed the finding immediately. This is very exciting news, said Daniel Halperin, an HIV specialist at the Harvard Center for Population and Development, who has argued that circumcision slows the spread of AIDS in the parts of Africa where it's common. There has been a debate in medical circles for years about whether circumcision is a good health choice. It's encouraging to see even more support for it as a good medical decision. Perhaps this will help some Jewish parents commit to a Brit Milah and end the debate on this subject. I guess this really cuts out the opposition to having a bris. Sorry, you know, you really can never get enough bris jokes, can you? And Larry Sherry, the Jewish relief pitcher who paired up with his brother Norm to lead the 1959 Dodgers to a World Series championship in Los Angeles, died this week. With teammate Sandy Koufax, the three made up a roster that was one-eighth Jewish, perhaps the most ever for a Major League Baseball championship team. Most people forget that Larry Sherry was the MVP of the 59 World Series and was much more important to that Dodgers team than Koufax was. Alav HaShalom, Larry. May your rest be in peace. Larry Sherry was 71 years old. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish This Morning Tiberiu Weiss, who has translated the Kaifeng stone inscriptions from the Jewish community of ancient China, although these inscriptions themselves date really to almost the Renaissance period, 1500s to about the 1660s or so. This community, although little known, has fascinated scholars for a long time. Tiberiu Weiss is a layperson with a great deal of experience in China, fluency in Chinese and Hebrew, has taught Chinese in a very variety of places, and has performed really a signal service by making this available. The book is called The Kaifeng Stone Inscriptions. Welcome back, Mr. Weiss.
Thank you.
What prompted you to do this translation now?
Before I started this project, I was very familiar. I've read all the materials, what existed in Western literature, Western and Chinese literature about the Chinese Jews. They absolutely found no trace of biblical history or even very very little Jewish trace. And that's kind of asked my question. I asked myself the question, why would the Jews write in inscriptions and not write about their own experiences? And so that was part of what bugged me for quite a long time. I was working at the time, so several years ago, I started working my research on a comparative study of China and the Jews. And when I got to the point that the inscription had to be fit into the context, it just didn't fit anywhere. So I thought to myself, well, perhaps in the inscriptions, the original text would be the part which I have to consult. At the beginning, I was quite apprehensive to deal with the original text. It was about 2,000 characters, the first inscription, about 2,000 characters of running text, no punctuation, and it's extremely difficult, and of course, was lacking any context. Nevertheless, I decided, well, take a look at it, and as I read and reread the Chinese text, I got this underlying feeling that it's different substantially from any translated version. I could feel the Jewish nature of the text, which was wrapped in Confucius terminology. And at the time, I thought that was what was missing from the translation. And it's interesting because once I finished the translation, I had a lecture with a group of Jews from England. And at the end of the lecture, one of the participants tells me, "Hey, TV, you know, this is part of the Eleinu prayer." I looked at him and said, "Well, you know, if you guess that one, I must be on the right track."
Well, there's the long sequence that puzzled Bishop White, the famous missionary in China. He just kind of passed it on without really commenting on it. And, of course, it turns out to be essentially the Shemona Esrei, the central Amidah, the central prayer text of every Jewish service. So really, this was a community that emerged not like the Ethiopians, not separated out before Rabbinic Judaism, but really a rabbinic Jewish community.
Pre-rabbinic.
Slightly pre-rabbinic, because if they had the Amidah, it can't be too far pre-rabbinic, since that's usually thought to be Mishnaic era development.
Right, right. I was contemplating it, and I was consulting with several people, and the only sign that I have, you know, that it should be pre-rabbinic, is that the 19 benediction is not there.
Right, they don't have a Lamal Shinim. So, but that would have been Gomorrah. So let's say it's from a Mishnah era, you know, say 1st, 2nd, even 3rd century development.
I would go with the 3rd century, right, CE, you know. What I was thinking of, and that's, you know, when I compare it to Chinese history, that they must have been in the outskirts of China, you know, in the western region, what they call, probably in the 2nd century, 2nd, 1st century BCE. And then when, you know, a Chinese general saw them, and he left us one sentence description in one of the records, which when I compared them, it was very biblical in nature. It basically described the Jews. And that's what prompted me to look for search for further material and analyze that particular one sentence. And I found some records in Chinese records from Chinese historians who they analyzed that and they didn't know what to do with that particular sentence, and they described the Jews
because they didn't know what the Jews were.
No, they didn't. You know, everybody looked the same to them.
Sure. Funny, they all look Chinese to me.
Well, yeah. Well, for them, is everybody looks Western. You know, right. The kippah and the turban. That was I think, you know, what really got my attention there.
There's a passage here which is very interesting. Well, there's many interesting passages. It's, you know, there's a very extensive set of inscriptions. I mean, it's really more than you expect to see in stone, I guess, if you're used to Middle Eastern inscriptions. But there's a passage here where it says, "When I ponder of the three religions, each has temples where they honor their Lord. The Confucians have the Da Cheng Temple, where they honor and worship Confucius. The Buddhists have the Shengrong Temple, where they honor Munui." I'm sure I'm mispronouncing some of this. "The Taoists have the Yuhuang Temple, where they worship the three purers. The pure in truth have the Israelite Temple, where they worship," and this is very interesting, "Wang Tian," which is listed as sort of high heaven. Is that Shemayim?
Wang Tian, right. Wang Tian. That's correct. And you know what? And you know, I mentioned even in the book that particular phrase, the Huang Tian expression, mm-hmm. was purposely used. It was never used for somebody living. It was and it was referred to the ancient emperors who were the sages, the sage emperors who were basically, you know, referred to God at the time. And so they used that one in order to compliment the emperor. That part, you know, in my opinion, that's when it was a reproduction of the interview with the Song Emperor. What they are trying to tell him, they're trying to tell that here is our religion, we are similar to China, to the Chinese Confucianists, but nevertheless we are very different. We worship somebody, we worship an Elohim, which they call it Huang Tian, they use that term, that there's no question that it existed.
So clearly they prayed in the vernacular.
That's correct.
In Chinese. You know, people may not be aware, but of course the Chinese Jewish community continued to be very active in trade and the Silk Route, and they were actually in commercial contact with Western Europe, which is really the other end of the world, throughout the Middle Ages, long before Marco Polo came and, quote-unquote, discovered China.
That's correct.
It's a very interesting community. What happened ultimately to the Jews of Kaifeng?
Well, I visited several times Kaifeng, and the last time, about two years ago, I was there, and you know, I never get the chance, you know, to be one on one with them. They always have to be an interpreter and a group of tourists. You have to get special permission to get to Kaifeng there. I was told that there's about 200 Jews still living there
in the Kaifeng area.
In Kaifeng, yes, that was about 2 years ago. Okay, so. But my question was, you know, when I visited there, my impression was that it becomes such a tourist attraction that it's very hard to differentiate between them, between the real Jews and pretend ones.
This must be the only place in the world where people try to pretend to be Jews.
That's correct. you know, I really would like one day, you know, just to get a chance. You know, there's this guy, he's Moshe Zhang, you know, he's the spokesman for the Jewish community. But I would like to give him the original Chinese transcription or inscription there and see if he would recognize any of the prayers, you know, or perhaps that whether he was taught any of that. You know, because that would be a test, you know, that they were aware of that or not, that they knew what is it.
And that they were a consistent community that went back to this period. It wasn't just a grafted on later.
No, there were gaps. You know, there are so many gaps, you know, in the history. Suddenly they disappear, and 500 years later they show up in our thriving community. We don't know anything what happened between these 500 years.
So really from like 1600 or 1660 or something up, and when the last inscription is from?
The last inscription is, it's 1663 B, it's called, because it's incomplete. We don't have a date. But I would assume that it's about a little bit later, probably 1670, 1700 even.
So roughly 370 years ago.
That's right.
330 years ago, sorry.
They were incorporated in China in the first century with the fall of the Han Dynasty in first century CE. And from then until the Tang Dynasty, about 800, we didn't hear about them. We hear about the merchants, and we found, you know, manuscript in Dunhuang. And then again, we don't hear anything until the interview with the emperor in the Song. So every 500 years, they show up again, and the thriving community. That would be something interesting to trace them down. I don't know if it's possible, you know.
Well, it might explain why Jews like Chinese food so much.
Yeah, and kosher Chinese.
Kosher Chinese food especially. There is one other passage I wanted to talk about briefly, and it's a fascinating book, the Kaifeng Stone Inscriptions. Really rich, many parallels to Jewish texts that we'd be familiar with if you're knowledgeable in Judaism at all, but also some very unusual parallels and clearly balancing with Chinese culture and Chinese religion. There's a passage that mirrors the section at the beginning of Pirkei Avot. It says the scriptures were transmitted in succession since the beginning, Adam to Noah, Noah to Abraham, Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to 12 tribes, the tribes to Moses, Moses, which is an interesting transition, Moses to Aaron, Aaron to Joshua, Joshua to Ezra. It's a little different sequence from what we see in the Mishnah, but quite similar in the notion of the transmission of this heritage, and then passed on to them somehow. Is this sort of a work of preservation, of sort of saving a heritage?
I believe that. Probably preserving the identity. Now, they knew that they won't last any longer. At least, I don't know if they knew, but they felt that, you know, the disasters, the wars, and all what came into in history at the time was against them. And they didn't have any contact with any foreigners. As a matter of fact, when Marco Polo showed up in China in 1605 and talked with the Aitian, the Jew Aitian, and tried to tell him that Judaism doesn't exist anymore, Aitian's reaction was, he said, wait a second, that's not possible. No, he didn't believe him.
Well, and of course, he was right.
Well,
not to believe him.
Right, he was right. But to tell you, and you know, and that wouldn't be surprised that kind of activity prompted them to write in the other inscriptions too. They wanted to preserve the identity of the Jews and said, you know, okay, this is how you are a Jew, okay? This is what we used to do. We used to pray the Aleinu, the Amidah, and the Birkat HaKohanim. We said, you know, at the end of the prayer, which is interesting because the third inscription, the 1663, it was written by not a Jew, but somebody who was either a neighbor or it was familiar with the Jews, a friend of the Jews, and he often probably visited the synagogue, and he wrote down what he saw and what the Jews told him there. And that I think it was interesting too, you know, to have a different perspective of the inscription.
Well, I want to thank Tiberio Weiss for giving us a very different perspective on the Jews of China. The book is called The Kaifeng Stone Inscriptions, and thank you for a wonderful visit on Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on your program.
My pleasure. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
Temple Emmanuel, the largest and fastest growing Reform congregation in Southern Arizona, invites you to become a part of all the wonderful ways we explore Judaism.
Are you new in town? Call us for a tour and an information packet. Like to know more about Judaism? From an outstanding preschool program and excellent Reform religious school to the finest adult education academy in the country, Temple Emmanuel offers contemporary Jewish learning with depth, authenticity, and creativity. Try our outreach classes and our hugely popular Taste of Judaism series. And if you're looking for the best Jewish music in town, this is the place. From our string quartet to our Avanim rock band, we include every variety of outstanding Jewish music available. Most importantly, we make Judaism fun and meaningful. Come join us at Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road. Call 327-4501 today.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Come back next Sunday when our guest will be the terrific author Anne Roifey. If you're here in Tucson tonight, come to Temple Emmanuel at 7 p.m. for vegetarian Chinese food and the great film Shanghai Ghetto. As you know, you gotta have Chinese on December 24th. Our playout this morning comes, for the first time in a while, from music not for Hanukkah. It's from the Sephardic group The Voice of the Turtle. It's called Escarica l'Issi de Oro. My friends, have a great day and a Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.